Accession number 22381, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Mr. Harry Gibbons, World War II glider pilot, recorded by Rodney Giesler on November the 8th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. Harry Gibbons, Reel 1.
That's just a microphone. Good. Okay, Harry, when were you born?
10-1-22.
And where were you born and brought up?
Bournemouth, Hertfordshire.
Mm-hmm.
Went to school there.
Yeah.
Left school at 14 and started work in the film industry.
Oh, really?
Well, of course, Bournemouth is Elstree, if you like.
How did you come to get working in the film industry?
Well, I was school captain, because particularly I was good at sports, played football and that sort of thing. And the company sent to the school for an office boy, and they sent me along for the job, and I got it. And that was with what was called in those days British International Pictures.
Oh, yeah.
In Bournemouth, or as it was called, Elstree. And that's where I started work.
And who were you? Who were the big names around when you were working there?
Oh, John Loder, John Lodge, Margaret Lockwood. The one person I can remember in particular coming over making a film was Maxie Bear. What a striking person he was. Big Maxie, he was fantastic. And his brother Buddy Bear came as well. But there were all those sort of people, you know, were there. And so I worked there for a time, then we moved.
Just going back there, your work involve you getting on the studio floor at all? Or did
well, I was an office boy, but you could go into the office and watch it.
Can you remember what pictures are being made there?
I can always remember Sanders of the River, and of course the Dark Singer, I forget his name.
Paul Robeson,
yeah. Fantastic.
So that's before the war then, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was before the war, that's right. Oh, it's before the war, yeah.
And Bournemouth Studios had only just been built, really, hadn't they?
Well, they've been there a while. Some BIP pictures have been there, but at the same time they were building another one, you know, at that time. And that BIP pictures then became Associated British Pictures. It changed hands, you know.
So how long did you spend at the studios?
I'm just trying to think. I think we must have left there because we moved. Mother was a widow, and we took in lodgers. And of course, another way of making money, Mum used to go, was crowd work in the studios. I think you used to get £1 a day or something, which was fantastic in those days. And so we got money like that. Anyway, we moved. I would have thought that we moved when I was about 16, and we moved to Iver in Buckinghamshire. And I, of course, transferred my job to Pinewood Studios. So I continued doing the same sort of work, but at Pinewood Studios.
So that would have been 1937 then, would it?
About 37, yeah, that's right, yeah.
I wonder what was happening. Was it Victoria the Great being filmed about that time?
Something like that, I think, yeah. You're right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I worked there for a while, and then I got a better job at Denham Studios. And I was at Denham Studios when the war broke out.
So what job were you doing at Denham?
Well, I've always been a pen pusher all my life, and went through accounts and costing and that type of thing. Costing sets, how much the sets cost and all that sort of thing, you know. So costing what the film making at the end of the day. And also got involved with wages departments and those sort of jobs, you know, I've always done that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, what films were on in production then? Was it?
I'm just trying to think.
Ships with Wings, was that?
Something like that. And What was the name of the lady that flew solo?
Amy Johnson.
Amy Johnson film was being made. Yeah. I can't think what it was
they
made.
They flew alone.
That's right, yes. Amy Johnson film was being made and things like that.
That was Annan Eagle, wasn't it?
Annan Eagle, yeah. Of course, she was one of the great film stars at that particular time, you know.
And your mum got crowd work there as well, did she?
She got crowd work, yeah. She used to get crowd work, yeah.
So you were there when the war broke out?
So I was there when the war broke out.
Yeah.
Now, that would have been, of course, in September 39.
And you would have been about 18?
18, that's right. Yeah, about 18, yeah.
Were you called up?
I was called up on January... I've got the papers there. I was called up on January the 15th, 42. So I was 20.
42?
42, so I was 20 in a few days.
Were you deferred then, or what?
Pardon?
Were you deferred then?
I can't see why for the life of me, but I didn't get my papers until then.
Really? So you worked at Denham all this time, did you?
Yes, Denham, yeah. I think, if I remember rightly, the film studio work was dying down a little bit at that time because of the war, you know. You might... Well, this is the time to mention... If you'd like to switch off a minute... And I said, I mentioned Mother had crowd work, you see, I said that, and I wonder whether that might be the time.
That would, because, I mean, your mother was German.
Yeah.
For the sake of the interview, can you tell me how it all happened and how your father met her and so
on? Yeah, sure, yeah, okay. Okay,
yeah.
Well, I've mentioned Mother doing crowd work. It might be of interest to know that she was, in fact, a German, and... My father, who was literally a Cockney born within the sound of bow bells, his family went out to Germany to follow their trade as leather workers, and he met my mother out there, married her, and they had five children there. And when the First World War broke out, he was interned because he was an Englishman in Germany. He'd never taken out German nationality. And subsequently, in 1919 then, he and his wife and the five children that were born out there, my mum, came to England. How or why they came to England, that was arranged, I don't really know. But they came to England and they initially lived, they were put into some kind of accommodation in East London, in Stepney, where I think they had a pretty rough time for a while. But eventually the five children went to school here. And they all grew up in England and got jobs and took out English nationality, of course. And Mum, of course, took out English nationality.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So that when the war broke out, my younger brother and I were eligible for service. And, I mean, she hated the name of Hitler. I mean, you know, she'd heard enough of it. So it wasn't too much of a problem, except, of course... As you can probably well imagine, her two sons going to fight against her country wasn't a very comfortable situation, but she accepted it. And of course we accepted it, obviously.
Did she get any problems when the Second World War turned up because she was German or not?
No. We were living in Iver then, and you said, remember, we were living in Iver, and if you think about it, that Iver and she went to war, and then my younger brother, there was no problems at all. No. Because she'd been accepted into the community. I mean, there's no question about that at all.
Fine. That's a very interesting sort of digression. Can we go on now to the point where you were called up in 1942, you said?
So January the 15th, 42, I was called up. And I was called into the London Regiment of Royal Fusiliers. And I had to report to... Barnstable, down in North Devon. Went to Barnstable. I did my infantry training there, obviously. I've always played football. And it's always to be good stead, because it's a funny thing what happens, but I got there and did that. We were put into houses, private houses we were billeted in, and that sort of thing. And... the company sergeant major, I don't know his name, but he was a Scotsman. You play a football, lad? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I got in the battalion football team. Well, now, when you do that, of course, it's a big help to your career, I think, to a certain degree. So you don't have to go on night guards on Friday night or things like that. It's literally that, you know. Anyway, so I did my training, and... Subsequent to that, some months after, I've got the exact date over there.
Hang on a minute. Right, so you were called up to the Royal Fusiliers in...
In January 42, where I did all my infantry training.
Good, then mainly on Exmoor.
Down in Barnstable, this was.
Yeah.
And that, and
but you'd exercise on Exmoor.
Exmoor and along the riverfront down there, and it was January. It was damn cold, I tell you. And so we did all that. And I always remember one of the funny things I mentioned. We did training literally just outside the town, down on the riverfront in a big park. And some of that training was, of course, included bayonet training. And the old dears used to be walking through the park with their dogs, and it was funny to hear some of the leave those poor boys alone, they used to say, you know, to the sergeant major who was taking it. It's things like this that I can remember, you know, because it sticks in your mind. Anyhow, I was there until the middle of April, and then for whatever reason I was transferred to the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, and I had to report to Derby. Normanton Barracks, it was called, I remember that. Normanton Barracks in Derby.
So the football team lost you then?
Yeah, but I managed to get into the football team at Derby then. And whether or why I was transferred, I don't know.
But it was a football transfer, wasn't it?
Probably it was. Yeah. And just outside at Derby there, there was this big MOD depot. And we were working there, doing clerical work and that there. And I think it might be one of the few instances where a round peg was put into a round hole because I was a clerical person, I suppose, you know.
Maybe that's why you were moved.
Maybe that, yeah. I think so, yeah, I think that. So I went there.
Because you're good at figures, I suppose, weren't
you? Yeah, well, I could use figures and doing that type of thing. Because you didn't have computers and that in those days.
So you're working in an office then?
So you're working in an office and then also down in the actual depot where all the stores were. The offices were in the stores. It was a hell of a big place, it was.
What was in the stores? Everything, I suppose.
Everything you could think of, yeah. Uniforms and no ammunition, of course, nothing like that, obviously, but those stores and that, all types of stuff. Anyhow, so I was there, and then the order was posted up regarding volunteers wanted for the Disguider Pilot Regiment. And I'd always sort of had an inkling I'd like to fly, but I'd never been able to do anything about it. And I volunteered.
And where did they send you?
I volunteered and I was accepted, and I went for an interview in Birmingham. And I was interviewed by, I don't know, a couple of colonels and whatever that was there interviewing you. Why do you want to join and all this sort of thing. And as a result of that, I was accepted as a volunteer. And on the 16th of October that year, I was transferred to the holding depot. And that was on Salisbury Plain at Till's Head, where you then were put through your paces to become a glider pilot. But there, of course, it was all infantry training, square bashing, and physical, very much physical. But I was physically fit. I always had been. And I succeeded in passing that. I think the pass rate was pretty low. Lots of chaps are what they called RTU, return to unit, because for whatever reason, whether it was physically or military or...
Did you have to do intelligence tests and things?
There were, to a certain degree, yeah.
But you hadn't seen an aeroplane at that time?
No, nothing like that then. So you're accepted and you're at Till's Head for quite some weeks. And once you've been accepted there, you're accepted in for flying training. And I went from there to Fargo Camp, and from there then we subsequently went away to do my EFTS, Elementary Flying Training School, and I did that in Buckinghamshire at Booker. And that was flying training on Tiger Moths and Magisters, powered aircraft, of course. And I successfully completed that.
Do you enjoy it?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, very much so. So that was that. And then the other movements after that, the next one of any importance was to go and do my first glider training on Hotspur gliders. And I did that at a place called North Luffenham, I think it was. Let me just get this right a minute. What, North Luffenham? No, it was Stoke Orchard, just outside Cheltenham. And that I enjoyed very much, flying Hotspurs. And once you've done that, your next stage, because by now you've been awarded your wings. And that was done at Fargo Camp.
Fargo Camp's where?
Fargo Camp is on the plains, not far from Shrewton.
Oh, I know, yeah.
It's out there, okay.
Tell me a bit about your glider training, your introduction to the Hotspur. I mean, what were you towed? You had a towed launch, didn't you?
Oh, you had towed. Oh, you had a towed launch.
I mean, what aeroplanes?
I can't remember what the tugs were.
No,
we used the Albemarles on the hawsers,
yeah.
Or Albemarles and Stirlings, and that. I'm trying to think what we were towed on.
What form did the training take, though, your first glider training?
You went up, obviously, with an instructor, you see, and he gave you instructions. And he released you and that sort of thing first of all, and you took over and you flew it, and he would be speaking to you and saying what you were doing, maintain. Bear in mind that before then you'd been taught on the ground how to fly a glider and that sort of thing. You just then put it into practice, you know. And I didn't find there much difficulty in doing it at all.
Presumably you had to be taught to land accurately.
Very much so. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So how were you taught that?
I think they give you some idea of the speed, you know, this is teaching you, you know, the speed to maintain and the height to maintain to land at a certain spot so far away or so on, you know. But you just learned it. It's funny, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Having completed that successfully, then the next thing was to go to heavy glider conversion. That was done to hawsers. And I did that at North Luffenham. That's up country somewhere. Suffolk or Norfolk.
Rutland. Well, it was. When Rutland was Rutland.
That's right. Yeah. That's it,
yeah.
And I did my heavy glider conversion course. Then came back to Fargo Camp, which was sort of the headquarters of the regiment. And then you were farmed out eventually to a squadron. And I was farmed out to D Squadron at Keevil, just outside Trowbridge, where also Bill Higgs was. And Bill Higgs and I crewed up for a while. We were actually flying together for a while. That was before there were such things as what they called second pilots. I mean, second pilots. And the second pilot's wings never came about until after Arnhem because of the loss of personnel. And that was a quick move.
So, Norman, before Arnhem, then, you only had one pilot per glider?
No, there were two, but you weren't called a second pilot. It was a pilot and a co-pilot. But you were both had your full wings. Whereas after Arnhem, you had a first pilot and a second pilot, and the second pilot hadn't gone through the same training that you'd gone through, and he had there were some special wings they brought out.
So he wasn't as highly qualified?
Not as highly qualified, no. They didn't have time. It was just a question of, filling up that seat.
Yeah.
And so that was that. And
tell me about your training at Keevil. I mean, you moved on to hawsers, which are heavier aircraft.
I'd done the heavy conversion at North Luffenham on the hawsers, and I was then qualified to fly a hawser.
And then presumably you had to train?
You did exercises, you did training, you took out on flights, landings, taking off landings, certain exercises were done where there were mass landings, and the worst type of thing, you know.
When you say taking off, did you have snatch takeoffs?
No, I was towed. And mostly we were towed by Stirlings. We were in, I forget the number of the squadron, Stirlings. And you gradually increased your proficiency, I suppose, by doing this type of thing, you know.
And what was the Hawser like to fly?
Fine.
An easy aeroplane?
I had no problems. I thought it was fine. One of the interesting things perhaps that happened was that initially when you learnt to fly, you learnt to fly in the high position over the top of the tug. You're looking down on the tug. And they considered, the powers that be, that that wasn't the best position because you've got a lot of breakages, tow rope. If you lost your position, the tow rope could break. And that happened, that could happen. Never happened to me, but it could happen.
How do you mean lose your position? Go off to the side?
Well, when you take off, the glider takes off first, and then the tug takes off, so you're already flying in a high position over the top of the tug. And you take off and you gain height, and you stay there in those days. But then eventually, as I say, the powers that be found out that if you flied in the low position, that's under the tug, you had more control, and the tow rope, you didn't get these broken tow ropes so much. But to get in that low position, once you'd reached a certain height, you had to go down into the low position. To do that, you had to pass through the slipstream of four Merlin engines, if you like, or whatever. So you had a bit of a shaky do, but once you got down there, It was a fact that it was much easier to fly looking up at the tug and holding your position than it was flying over the top. So eventually, one of the changes that they made was flying in the low position rather than in the high position.
So up to D-Day, presumably, you were just flying exercises all the time?
Yeah, flying exercises. There was quite a lot of different exercises that we were flying. Learning to mass land, of course, land in the correct spot and all this type of thing, you know.
Keeping out of the way of the other gliders.
That's it, landing with heavy loads. We did do exercises at Bryce Norton with what they called live loads. Some of those live loads were made up of paratroops that used to come, and they hated it because they didn't have a parachute. And in other instances, that the load might have been made up of, as I recall, was of railway sleepers, just to make the load up, so that you were flying with a load, you know. But sometimes you did have live loads.
Did you have any tricky moments?
I had a tricky moment at Bryce Norton. I was flying with an RAF man. And we were on a special, this is a special exercise, where the object of the exercise was to get down as quickly as you could, with full flap. And we had a load of, if I remember rightly, we had a heavy load on of sleepers. And he'd forgotten that we had a heavy load on. And he took the action that you would have taken with an empty glider. And what happened was put the flaps on, stuck the nose down, and started gaining speed, at a terrific speed. And he pulled it out, and we literally went round again, as they call it, and came back in and landed. Otherwise, that was about the only thing that ever happened to me that might have been...
How were these loads secured? Because they were right behind you, and if you stop suddenly, they come right through the cockpit, wouldn't they?
They were secured to the side of the glider. It was quite strong. I mean, like you carry jeeps, but they were secured to the floor of the glider quite well. There's no otherwise, as you rightly say, you know. I think that was one of the problems, with the Hamilcar. You know the Hamilcar. Mm. Where they sat at the top, and I think if they, with the load, and they carry small tanks, if they hit very muddy ground or soft ground, they used to turn over. which wasn't very nice for the pilots. Mm. Mm. So that was more or less completed my training and whatever, you know, and I was quite happy doing it.
So what year have we reached now?
We've got to be in 44 now. Mm. Oh yeah, we're into 44 now.
So
yeah.
D-Day was on the horizon.
D-Day was on the horizon. Now at that time then, we were at Tarrant Russell. D squadron was down at, there was two squadrons at Tarrant Russell. D squadron, I forget the other one, and we were down there at that particular time. Yeah. And D-Day came along, and as I said, I was grounded for a while. I went to...
Why was that?
We'd been on the firing ranges, anti-tanks, and I'd had ear trouble. And I went to hospital in... Shaftesbury. I was sent to Shaftesbury Hospital. And as a result of the report and that, I was grounded, but only for a while. Mm. And as I say, so that happened, the lad saw the lads off, and saw a lot of them come back, including Bill Higgs. Mm. And then it went on from there.
You'd done all the rehearsals for D-Day?
Oh, yeah.
I've been on that, yeah. And that was what, forming up into a stream?
And doing all that type of thing. Mm. And then we moved from Tarrant, so I was at Tarrant for a while. Then we moved from, you know, one thing that happened at Tarrant Ruston, I don't know if Bill Higgs mentioned this to you, but it was night flying, and we were both on night flying that night. I think I was flying with him, I'm not sure, but we were both night flying. And there was an unfortunate incident when one of our gliders crashed into a parked tug, and the first pilot was badly injured, Louis Helford, and the second pilot, Blackie Blackburn, we called him, he was killed. It was most unfortunate. And Bill and I went up on, he came from Leeds, we went up on his funeral, which
was
a military funeral.
That
was at the airfield, yeah, crashed at night. Subsequent then, after D-Day and whatever, our squadron was moved to Keevil, which is just up the road from here at Trowbridge. Mm. And we continued with training and that sort of thing. We used to go drinking in Bradford-on-Avon, and that's where I met my wife, and that's where Bill met his wife. He's probably told you that, has he? and also Bob Rose, another one, who's still living at Bradford-on-Avon. Bob met his wife there. And that's how I came to settle in the West Country. Anyhow, so subsequent to that, then Arnhem came along.
Did you train for any other exercise, any other
Yes,
assaults?
There was not so much training, but we were all moved up to just outside Reading. Big USA. I tell you what, the people used to demonstrate outside there, the
peace. Yeah, I know.
Okay.
It was
Aldermaston. So we were transferred to Aldermaston, and we were going to be towed by the Americans who were there. No comment. And the object of the exercise that we were told was to close what was known as the Falaise Gap. I don't know if you know, where the German armour was, after D-Day, was escaping out back through the Falaise Gap. So you appreciate, I'm back flying again now. Mm-hmm. And we went to Aldermaston, and we were briefed and all the rest of it, but the front was so fluid that by the time we would have taken off, it moved on and on, and it was cancelled. And we came back to Keevil. And I suppose the next big thing after that was Arnhem.